Welcome. Good evening. See, I think I know most people. I'm not sure. What's your name?
I'm a visitor. My name is Martin.
Martin, welcome. My name is Kokyo. And we have our weekly talk tonight on the eve of Sesshin. And it's a painful, difficult world we live in, is it not? So today, one of the big news items is this mass killing in San Bernardino. 14 people, for unknown reasons, killed close to home, and that it's California. And and it seems like it was just last week there was another big killing, and then all that's going on in Paris and so on. And so when I heard this news today, I thought, because it's so recent that there was another one of these, I thought, how often is this happening, really? Maybe I don't watch the news that much. So I kind of looked it up, how many mass killings, right? And it turns out that a lot of other people seem to think of this today, too, because it's so soon, right? So there's people were posting such articles like, a so-called mass killing is defined by some people as four people or more. And in the U.S. alone, I think it was in 2015 so far, there's something like 355 mass killings. This is like 365 days a year, right? So there's some days when there's not, but there's many days where there's more than one. Some news stories today said that there were two today, actually. There was another one in Georgia. I think four people in Georgia that kind of got underreported since there were 14 in California. So it's shocking and horrible. And yet it's going on all the time. I was surprised. I mean, I was glad that I looked, but I was shocked to see that, it's almost as many mass killings as there are days in the year. Not to mention singular killings, right? In this country alone. What's going on here, right? I don't think this has always been the case. Where does this come from, and how can we respond? It seems to me that killing is like maybe the most extreme form of aversion, basic aversion. We don't like what's going on with someone so much that we feel must destroy them. It's like delusion gone to its extreme. So, as often with these kind of events, it reminds me to look back at myself. I haven't been involved in any mass killings recently, but these seeds of delusion, I can see them in this mind stream, right? The aversion, grasping an aversion in small ways and sometimes bigger ways, and based on the this false belief in separation. So this kind of news is, I think, a good wake-up call for all of us to just keep remembering the gift of this practice. In some ways we could say so simple to just remember that there is no separation truly between all of us beings. This awareness manifesting through this body and mind, and that awareness manifesting through that body and mind. We can't find any boundaries between them. The bodies seem to be separate, but we can't find any separation really between my awareness and your awareness. I think this is where we meet, in one mind. But as soon as dualistic thought starts proliferating, then it seems like vast separation sometimes. So in Zazen, we can return to this non-separation. In silence and stillness, together we drop away the false projections of me and you and so on. I think there's no other way. I mean, it's good to also, I think, petition for gun control and so on in the political realm. There does seem to be a problem with guns in this country. But for ourselves here and now, also, we have this practice. And that's our unique discovery, that we can settle into this present moment, relax into our true nature more and more deeply and completely, until that sense of separation seems to dissolve. And therefore, the grasping and the aversion based on that delusion can decrease. And as we know, it's a lifetime project. It's no easy, it's no quick fix. Right. Over and over again. And then we have times like this coming week, or everyone is welcome to participate in any way that you'd like to. This Rohatsu Sesshin, 7 days of just sitting in present open awareness, watching grasping and aversion arise in the mind, and letting them go, returning to the simple, ungraspable awareness itself. It's a training. It's a ongoing practice. So sometimes we have retreats like this where we get to do it a lot. And there's a group of people sitting all day through these days, and the schedule is posted on the bulletin board, and everyone's welcome to come sit whenever you can, any time throughout the day. You can come in quietly at the beginning of a period of Zazen and join in the silence and stillness. And this sesshin celebrates Shakyamuni Buddha's great awakening. So all over the Zen world, people are sitting at this time. The tradition is December 1st through 8th, and we're pretty close to that. So we can, this session especially, throughout the year, this is the one where we really kind of line up with the rest of the Zen world in Japan and America and Europe and all around the world. Many, many people sitting Rohatsu Sesshin right at this time. The Buddha's great awakening. We celebrate Buddha's birthday and Buddha's passing from this world day. But Buddha's awakening, Buddha's enlightenment day tends to be emphasized the most, quite wonderfully. Because that's what we're drawn to. We appreciate the Buddha's birth and we appreciate his passing. But his night under the Bodhi tree so many centuries ago, where he awoke to present, open awareness, free of grasping and aversion, and taught method and practice passed down and interpreted in myriad ways, on and on down to us. This session, I intend to look into with all of you who are attending the third Zen ancestor's Song of the Trusting Mind, the Shin Shin Ming Song of the Trusting Mind begins, "The great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. When longing and aversion are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinion for or against." Such simple, straightforward words, so challenging to practice, are they not? I always get a little worked up the day before Sesshin. There's so much to prepare. There's so many details to take care of. And sometimes I think, just let it go. It doesn't matter that much to see what happens. But it's, I kind of feel like it's also kind of an offering to set up as much as we can beforehand so that it goes smoothly, just to support everybody in it, so that so when the session starts, we can just flow along with it. But in the name of this setup, sometimes the details can become stressful. And putting aside all kinds of business and so-called worldly affairs for 7 days, mostly like email stuff, takes a whole day to like tidy up business. For a week. It's amazing how complex modern life is, that it's so hard to disconnect like that. So something ironic about getting a little bit like stressed about setting up a time of no stress. And then just watching the the mind do its thing. the great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. Of course, preferences arise due to conditions that will continue to arise according to conditions. And our practice is not to hold them too tightly. We like some things more than other things. That's just natural. And yet if we hold that, and like we really can't be at peace unless we get what we like, then the great way becomes difficult. So Zazen is the essential settling in to the mind of holding no preference. It's a good container to watch the preferences arise and not hold them. See what they are, that they actually can't be grasped. They're just dependent, arising thoughts, and watch them go. But all day long, we can practice as much as we can, not holding preferences. Things often don't go our way in this life, so when they don't, that's our opportunity to practice the trusting mind. In a way, our practice is so simple, and in some ways, there's subtlety, depth of subtlety we can continue to clarify forever. And then there's just the devotion to enacting it, just doing it over and over. I think both these sides are important. Get clarifying more and more deeply, however deeply we have clarified in every given moment, devote ourselves to, again, here, now, remember and settle into this ease that's always available because it's who we are. So I could say more, but I thought since we have this night before Sesshin, and we have these events going on in the world, is there anything anyone would like to bring up or question about the practice, our practice in general, or the practice of Sesshin? Ancestors poem, Song of the Trusting Mind, or we could say Song of the Mind of Trust, or some would translate it as trusting in mind, trusting the mind, or the trusting mind. And yes, faith or trust in Buddha nature. You've maybe heard teachings about our true nature. is often emphasized in Zen. And sometimes it sounds very exalted and extremely subtle and hidden, like a jewel hidden in the mountain of form. We sometimes have images like that. And yet, it's also described as totally straightforward, ever-present, always here, that which cannot be lost, the only thing that cannot be lost. But yet we trust many things that can be lost. Instead, that's just our, more maybe our human nature. But our Buddha nature, we could say, is our ever-present, open, clear awareness here and now. There is an awareness, no matter how agitated and involved in grasping and aversion we are, there's an awareness that's just aware. Not even aware of anything. It's just empty of any fixed characteristics, any objects separate from it, and it's knowing and clear and awake. This empty clarity, always here, is what we can trust, we can take refuge in. The trusting mind, the mind that trusts this open awareness. It's not even really mind. We can't really call it anything. But the mind can trust this nature. Or if we want to call it mind, it's what is most trustworthy. And the wonderful thing about this awareness is that it's always available. So when completely caught up in some kind of projection of this is really great, or this is really horrible, or anything else, right behind that emotion or thought or experience of any kind is this awareness. Behind it, throughout it, pervading it, the very nature of the emotion is this awareness. It's just that when its features manifest as characteristics of pleasant or unpleasant or this feeling or that, then that's what we pay attention to. We miss the all-pervading, ordinary background awareness. So in this sense, our practice could be seen as very simple. It's just that we're so used to paying attention to the things of this world. Which we have to in order to negotiate the world. But in Zazen, we can just use this opportunity to pay attention in this different kind of way. Often we don't. We use zazen to do something else. It's a good productive time for assessing our life or something like that. And of course there are other practices we can do during the time of zazen that are also training and taming the mind. And yet such a practice as this total simplicity is available always too. Can we find it? This trustworthy awareness now? It's here. And what do you think? Is there either we find it and there's no issues, or there's some doubt, like, I don't know about that. I can't quite see it. Maybe we're looking for it as something. Do you have doubts? Do you feel you could trust this ever-present, ungraspable, non-object? Does it make sense? Especially for those who haven't heard of this much? Does it sound too abstract?
It's kind of letting go so that something more than ourselves in terms of how we act in everyday life with wisdom and compassion can come true. Us. As the sitting helps me, and I think many of us, be able to step back and see our normal scripting, and then when we're in our life situation, to realize the script and step back from it and then act more appropriately, more kindly. Something like that.
Yeah, it seems like something other than ourselves,
yes,
you said.
So,
yeah, maybe the way we usually think of ourselves as I'm Kokyo, I'm this body and mind and collection of karmic tendencies conditioned since I was born or before, that version of myself. Yeah, I could say it's something other than that self, but some might call it like, it's who we really are. You could say like our true self in a way. Our true nature. It's not ours exactly. It's not personal. And yet, it's not impersonal either because it's only known through this body and mind, personal experience. Seems like there's a transpersonal or a transcendent person, one who is coming through our body and mind experience. As the Zen teacher Linji said, which I much appreciate, there's a true person of no position and no fixed characteristics moving in and out through the portals of our face, through our senses. Our senses are our seeing and our hearing and smelling and tasting and touching are not that person, but that person is moving in and out through these senses. The true person of no position. So, if we look at something and say, is that it? Then that's somebody with something with position. And then, after Linji describes it this way, he says, if you haven't seen this person, then just look. Look. And we might ask, well, where should we look for such a person? Not really in the senses and the portals of our face, not in any experience, and yet not separate from any experience either. That which is clear, awake, and free of any edges or divisions. Right at the same time as edges and divisions might be appearing. It's never about having to change anything to find this trustworthy one. And then if we start to trust it a little bit, and we can even inquire, get a little bit more familiar with this one, then you know, it's easy to make it into something as we inquire, of course, is a danger here, but trusting, while trusting this one, we can ask, could this one ever engage in mass killing? And it seems that no, this one cannot. That's why this is the source of nonviolence. Mass production. This one doesn't create anything, actually, right? Doesn't produce or create anything. It doesn't do anything. It can't be destroyed or enhanced. It can't be lost. And I think anything that could be lost or be made into anything or destroyed or even enhanced is not so trustworthy, actually. Not completely trustworthy. I mean, we can trust people to some extent, to keep to their word and so on, but not completely. Nothing that's conditioned is truly and completely trustworthy. But this one seems to be, completely trustworthy. The great way that is without difficulty can be trusted. Do you have any doubts or anything to bring up?
Thinking about the dynamic tension between this trust, which feels like an active something, in juxtaposition to something that is complete surrender. The ability to act in trusting is also an act in not acting.
So I think true trust is not an activity. Yeah. It's not a doing. And this maybe points to this complete trust cannot be contrived at all. Sometimes we get a little inkling. We hear some teaching about the true person or so on, and we think something resonates in us. I would say maybe that's our Buddha nature is like awakened unconsciously, unbeknownst to us. Something in us starts resonating just hearing some teachings sometimes. I don't know if you have that experience. I have. And without really knowing it for sure. And that's when there's a little bit of trust is starting to come, but it's not complete trust. And maybe then we're like, I want to trust, that sounds good. I want to trust this, but maybe there's a little bit of doubt at the same time. And then, so maybe that kind of trust, as we're working on developing it, is a kind of doing activity. And in the end, there's the potential for this completely uncontrived trust that just like, that where nobody could convince us otherwise. But I think it's a beautiful thing that there's can be a little trust, just this resonance. Our Buddha nature starts vibrating with the vast, inconceivable nature of reality itself. There's a kind of relationship there. So sometimes it's said, we've been studying the middle way for these past weeks, and one of the great commentators on Nagarjuna's middle way is Chandrakirti. The middle way is sometimes spoken of as emptiness, is another word for this true person of no position. Emptiness, completely inseparable from appearances of people and so on. And Chandrakirti says, when just ordinary people sometimes hear teachings about emptiness, even just a little bit, like Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. As is said in the Heart Sutra. We might hear a line like that, and Chandrakirti says, some ordinary people, when hearing about emptiness, their hair starts to stand on end, and they get goosebumps, and their eyes get moist, like tear up a little bit. I'd say maybe once in a while we'll hear some teachings where they really resonate and we just feel that way. It's a great gift, I think, when that happens. And I think it's wonderful that in ancient India, Chandrakirti, at the beginning of his long, highly complex philosophical treatise, begins it like this. Certain people just hear about emptiness and they get goosebumps and their eyes become moist, he says in poetic Sanskrit verse. And he said that such people are suitable vessels for hearing all this convoluted or, you know, difficult philosophical teachings about emptiness. It's, in other words, it's not just some dry philosophical exercise to define reality. This is like resonating with our deepest being, these teachings. I think it's beautiful. There's a kind of almost like first, that it's best if there's a kind of emotional connection, sounds like. Otherwise, it's going to be really dry and tedious to study this kind of thing. And again, I think we can't really, that's not something we can contrive, but it's this openness. We're just open. And that's, I think, the way to practice Zazen, and the way to also listen to Dharma and hear teachings is just, it's a practice. May I be as open as possible. It's hard sometimes. I find it hard sometimes. I've heard this teaching like a million times, and like I'm ready for something new, and that, then it's almost guarantee that our eyes will not become moist. How can we stand another Dharma talk about the same old thing? It's always the same old thing. I mean, we might get little bits, nuances of some new fancy way of putting it once in a while. But it's kind of like we've probably heard the true Dharma. We've all heard the true Dharma many, many times. It's just a matter of like, how open are we to it in each moment? Yeah, it's kind of like the same as devotion. How can I be devoted to the Dharma? We could also say take refuge in the Dharma, even the same old Dharma I've always heard. Because we could say, I know it, I know it, but am I practicing it all the time? No, never. So I could hear it again and again and again. Often the ancient teachers say, we have to just hear it again and again and again. It seeps gradually in. Yes.
I think, I don't know about my eyes getting moist, but all I have to do is to try, is to look for something I can hold on to and not, it won't change. And, you know, and I can't find it. And so that leads me back to the emptiness. I let go of what I can't grasp anyway. I'm not quite sure if that makes any sense.
So when you look...
When I look and I realize that I can't hold on to anything that won't change.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice exercise to try to hold on to something that won't change and see that it's impossible.
Yeah, I get reminded regularly.
Yeah, in a way we're all getting reminded all the time, but we often don't notice. So that's great to notice. Yeah, or...
Sometimes it'll come back to me.
Yeah, so maybe, do I hear also what you're saying is we sometimes look for something to hold on to, and in trying we can't, and then we're at this kind of crossroads in this moment, which happens millions of times throughout the day. I think we're at that crossroad. We can either become frustrated, which is, we like to choose that one, or we can say, this moment, this crossroads is a chance to ask, what do I trust right now? And we might say, I don't trust any of this because I can't get a hold of it. Then I think that's very good, because we can't trust any of it. And what do I trust or take refuge in then at such a time? And it's tricky because it's not, you know, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, these refuges, if we make them into something to get a hold of, then that's they're not really the true refuges. We like to, though. I mean, I notice that tendency all the time. I want a refuge that I can get at least a little hold of, a slightly packaged refuge, you know, wrapped with a bow, because the unwrapped one that has no edges even or anything is like, well, how could we take a refuge in that? It doesn't make any sense.
There's no floor.
There's no floor. Can we take refuge in floorlessness? Yes, Richard.
When I try to put that in a positive way that seems to feel okay to me, I think of abiding in the wonder of not knowing, which equals miraculous. I mean, And so that starts to become a different. It takes trust in a different way. It's almost like what a gift for us to every moment be living in a miracle.
That's a beautiful phrase. Abiding in the wonder of not knowing, which is miraculous.
It's miraculous.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't that be kind of a cool way to...
Yeah. Yeah. So hard to abide in the wonder of not knowing, even though it is miraculous. We say, well, sounds good. I'll abide in that. But in fact, it's so difficult because we want to know. We want to have something to rely on, something to rely on. We're looking for something stable. But there's nothing stable to rely on in the world of impermanent appearances, and yet we can say there is. It's not really something, but there is a stable reliance. It's just not a thing, and this is frustrating to the human mind that wants something to rely on. So we can practice reciting and with feeling, I take refuge in Buddha, not some person in India, although there's that aspect, but that true nature of awareness itself. I take refuge in Dharma, not the words of that person in India, although it includes that, but what they're pointing to, the ungraspability of everything. I take refuge in Sangha, not all those followers of the Buddha and the Buddha's Dharma, although it includes that, but the true nature of the myriad beings, the 10,000 manifestations sharing one mind. It's more the one mind that we all share, we can take refuge in. I appreciate how in the mornings we, at the beginning of morning service, each morning, we start by this, like, repentance, this confession verse, one of these ancient verses, all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So sometimes it sounds like, it almost sounds self-deprecating. Like, am I really that bad? Am I just like constantly having to confess this, all this greed, hate, and delusion born through this body, speech, and mind? But I think it can be done in this really positive way. It is kind of humbling, to be sure. It's not a verse that we can say, recite with arrogance and pride, actually. I think impossible. And yet, not self-deprecating either. More just like, more like, this is, I just acknowledge that this is what obscures the view of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This ancient, twisted, you know, all like wrapped up and tangled in ways that we can't even figure out, that kind of karma, that kind of intentional activity of body, speech, and mind coming forth from the illusion of a separate self. I fully avow means like, here it is, like, one more day, I seem to have created heaps of karmic effects. Once again, we say it three times to make sure we acknowledge it. And then right after that, it's kind of like, it kind of purifies it by just saying it, and with sincerity, it kind of acknowledges this is what obscures Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I just admit it. Wow, I forgot. Until I recited this verse, I forgot. I spent a whole day obscuring Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now this morning, I again avow or confess, admit, another 24 hours of obscuring Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then right afterwards, Buddham Saranam Gacchami, I take refuge in Buddha. Again, I intentionally trust the inconceivable, the not knowing, what was it again, Richard?
Abiding
in not know, in the wonder of not knowing. Yeah. I take refuge in abiding in not the wonders, not knowing that is a miracle.
I'm not sure if you are terrified about not knowing.
Not knowing, like, this is the most, you know, we could say, well, I'm just a kind of ignorant country bumpkin, and I don't really know anything, especially, like, I don't know what Chandrakirti is talking about with all this Madhyamaka philosophy, and, like, therefore, like, how nice to not know. I think it's not so much, like, I'm happy to just not know. It's more like the deepest kind of not knowing, like not being able to actually get a hold of an object. Getting a hold of an object is defined in Buddhism as knowing. That's how we know things. There seems to be a subject that arises with or an object. They're almost like they're connected, or at least they're arise interdependently, and that's called knowing. When we start to see, when we start to look for the subject, we're kind of independent of the object, just a subject, it's in and of itself, we can't really find one, like Lenore said, we can't find a floor or a subject, and when we look for the object, like the floor, we can't find it on its own. They only appear in dependence on each other, like a mirage appears in the desert when the light and the moisture is just right. So therefore, we really, that in that way of not knowing, that way of, we of course we know many, many things, conventionally speaking, but ultimately we can't really know anything Did that make sense? A little bit?
Of course not.
If I can speak about it, that's not it.
The way that can be spoken of is not the true way, Lao Tzu said.
Where I think there's a somewhere where if you're not knowing is most intimate.
Yes. Yeah. One of the Zen ancestors. Yeah. Ditsang and Fayan's conversation. But is that what you meant, Shou, by clarifying not knowing? Or would you like to add anything to clarify not knowing? Yeah, I think that's another way to say same thing, is that intellect also is its sensory experiences of seeing objects, but mostly we're involved in no intellect knowing some fact, knowledge, might say. And same thing, that the dualistic mind knowing something is that illusion. Really like a mirage or a rainbow when we try to look for what we know or the knower. But awareness itself is free of the knower and the known. We might say, well, how is that so? I think one way we could say it is awareness is just like this big empty space. Not even really big, because that's a boundary and a size. It's not big or small. It's so minute it fits into spacelessness. So vast it transcends dimension, it's, the ancestors say. So that kind of spacious awareness that can't be destroyed or enhanced. Within that, because there's nothing outside of it, everything that appears must be, we could say in words, clunky words, within that. So then we can have subjects and objects appearing within it. We can have the appearance of a knower and a known appearing within this big space, but they're both just appearances on the screen. And even that dualistic knowing itself, consciousness, dualistic consciousness is another like appearance. Maybe kind of hard to see that. It's not the same, dualistic consciousness is not the same as this non-dual awareness. But it's also not completely separate from it. It's not, we have to destroy dualistic consciousness to recognize awareness. If so, we might have to have part of our brain removed. It may be that in deep meditation we can completely disengage dualistic consciousness temporarily, but this kind of awareness includes dualistic consciousness. It doesn't have to eliminate anything to be free. But if we believe dualistic consciousness is the end of the story, then we can't. It hurts. Yes, it hurts. It hurts, and we have mass killings at the worst end of the spectrum. I mean, can we trust that such a simple practice could be the root to true peace in the world, true nonviolence?
What do you call it? Do you think that returning back to awareness would pacify the intellectual mind?
Pacify the intellectual mind?
Yeah.
Well, as I was saying, I think it's not so much about just eliminating the intellectual mind, but may, in a way, they could say, recognizing awareness and steeping this body and mind in it, then starts to actually change the body and mind experience, it seems. I think that's the cool thing, is it's like the body and mind experience in a way is a little, almost seem like it's one of the mirages. It's not really what we think it is. It's the karmic body and mind, and yet by like dropping this body and mind into this boundless awareness, and kind of like over and over again, seems to like gradually transform the body and mind, change in a way, like change the karmic predicament in a more like towards non-violence in the world. And the world is another one of the appearances, but the world starts to become transformed or conditioned, evolved through trust in awareness, the trusting mind.
And you say about that because there's so many amazingly brilliant people in this world, I really have been in touch with that awareness and did their best of trying to convey it. And it more or less, depending on which words they choose, depending how the words they understood at the time, depending how other people later on understood the words at that time, yeah, still in a situation where we are.
You mean those who were really in touch with it, you say, did realize true non-violence, you might say, but they had a hard time conveying it, so it didn't. I think that's.
A hard time conveying it, and other people have a hard time understanding what they even thought.
Yeah, for sure. If it were easy, we wouldn't do things like sit for 7 days without moving, or year after year keep practicing and studying these teachings over and over and hearing it from new angles again and again. It's not easy. And, you know, you could say we're all like circling around the inconceivable and maybe evolving and getting glimpses, you know, that kind of like poke little holes in our karmic walls, but it's not easy. Yeah, but the very process itself is such a joy. I mean, almost like there's nothing else to do, is there not? And it's not a matter. It's like not an all or nothing matter. It's not like we can recognize awareness once and that's that world peace follows forever after. Of course not. Because Shakyamuni Buddha, the depth of his awakening pervaded this world for throughout space and time all the way up to now, and yet look at all the problems. So what do you mean? You just want to make sure that we remember that it's not a super easy quick fix.
Or just more to not expect one-to-one kind of results, you know, like be in touch with a piece of love and eternity and then the new appearances coming up the next moment. I mean, they're here to test your understanding, right?
Everything's testing us, yeah. But it seems like there's no other way. I mean, there's many, many practices, right? A lot that we can cultivate to recognize this awareness and apply it to our life again and again and again. And we could say, very slow, gradual path. And each moment of recognition and remembering is like a sudden remembering what to trust. It's always sudden in the moment of trust, could be even complete trust, and then very gradual applying this to our conditioned karmic life again and again and again. So, thanks for being here and doing this work that is not easy. Yeah. And sometimes we start practicing and sometimes it feels like people kind of get something, they kind of get it, they really didn't get it at first, and they kind of get it, and maybe a week, maybe a few months, maybe a few years, it's like, yeah, I really got it now, so now I'm done, I go on to the next thing. God, it would really, like, there's no end. I mean, it can take many forms, it doesn't have to be in the Zendo, but the endless practice of unfolding, awakening, and benefiting beings, and bringing non-violence to this world is, if we think we could ever reach the end of that, that would be a supreme delusion. If we think that. If we know that. So we dedicate the positive energy of just gathering tonight to sit together and contemplate Dharma and what's trustworthy. Something positive here, I think, whether we know it or not. If anything positive here is flourishing, then we offer it, we give that, we send it to all beings everywhere, all suffering beings, especially those involved in violence in this world. Through our intention, may all beings realize peace. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.